The Wilderness Within. The Sleeping Beauty and the Poacher, and a P.S. about Sylvia Townsend Warner. This piece was written as a contribution to the anthology Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, Women Writers Explore Their Favorite Fairy Tales, edited by Kate Bernheimer in 1998. Francine Prose's piece about the Sleeping Beauty, which I mention here, is also in that anthology. My story, The Poacher, can be found in my collection, Unlocking the Air. Influence, the anxiety of influence. It's enough to give you influenza. I've come to dread the well-intended question, what writer or writers influenced you as a writer? What writer or writers didn't? How can I name Wolfe or Dickens or Tolstoy or Shelley without implying that 100, 1,000 other influences didn't matter? I evade, telling the questioners they really don't want to hear about my compulsive reading disorder or changing the playing field. Schubert and Beethoven and Springsteen have had a great influence on my writing. Or, well, that would take all night, but I'll tell you what I'm reading right now, an answer I learned from being asked the question. A useful question, which leads to conversation. Then there was the book, The Anxiety of Influence. Yes, I know who's afraid of Virginia Woolf. Still, I'm faintly incredulous when I hear that phrase used seriously. The book about being anxious because you learned things from other writers came out at the same time that a lot of us were energetically rejoicing in the rediscovery and reprinting of older and earlier woman writers. The rich inheritance that had been withheld from all writers by the macho literary canon. While these guys were over there being paranoid about influence, we were over here celebrating it. Well, all right, if some authors feel threatened by the very existence of other, older writers, what about fairy tales? Stories so old they don't even have writers. That should bring on a regular panic attack. That the accepted male notion of literary influence is appallingly simplistic is shown first, not last, but first, by the fact that it overlooks, ignores, disdains the effect of pre-literature, oral stories, folktales, fairy tales, picture books, on the tender mind of the pre-writer. Such deep imprints are, of course, harder to trace than the effect of reading a novel or a poem in one's teens or twenties. The person affected may not be conscious of such early influences, overlaid and obscured by everything learned since. A tale we heard at 4 years old may have a deep and abiding effect on our mind and spirit, but we aren't likely to be clearly aware of it as adults, unless asked to think about it seriously. And the person affected may be deeply unwilling to achieve consciousness of such influences. If seriousness is limited to discourse of canonical literature, we may well be embarrassed to mention something that some female relative read aloud to us after we'd got into bed in our jammies with our stuffed animals. Yet it may have formed our imagination more decisively than anything we ever read. I have absolutely no idea of when I first heard or read The Tale of the Sleeping Beauty. I don't even remember, as I do for some stories, the illustrations or the language of a certain edition. I certainly read it for myself as a child in several collections, and again in various forms when I was reading aloud to my own children. One of those versions was a charming checkmate book, an early example of the pop-up genre. It was good magic, the way the thorny paper rose hedge leapt up around the little paper castle. And at the end, everybody in the castle woke, just as they ought to, and got right up off the page. But when did I first learn that that was what they ought to do? The Sleeping Beauty is one of the stories that I've always known, just as it's one of the stories that we all know. Are not such stories part of our literary inheritance? Do they not influence us? Does that make us anxious? Francine Prose's article on The Sleeping Beauty elegantly demonstrates, by the way, that we don't know the stories we think we've always known. I had the 12th fairy and the whole spindle business clear in my mind, but all that after the marriage hanky-panky was news to me. As I knew it, as most Americans know it, the story ends with the prince's kiss and everybody getting ready for the wedding. And I wasn't aware that it held any particular meaning or fascination for me, that it had had any influence on me, until, along in my 60s, I came on Sylvia Townsend Warner's evocation of the tale in a tiny poem. It is in her collected poems. The Sleeping Beauty woke. The spit began to turn. The woodmen cleared the brake. The gardener mowed the lawn. Woe's me. And must one kiss revoke the silent house, the birdsong wilderness? As poetry will do, those words took me far beyond themselves, straight through the hedge of thorns into the secret place. For all its sweet brevity, the question asked in the last two lines is a total revisioning of the story, a subversion of it. Almost, it revokes it. The pall of sleep that lies upon the house and grounds is supposedly the effect of a malicious spell, a curse. The prince's kiss that breaks the spell is supposed to provide a happy ending. Townsend Warner asks, was it a curse, after all? The thorn hedge broken, the cooks growling at their porridge pots, the peasants laboring again at their sowing or harvesting, the cat leaping upon the mouse, father yawning and scratching his head, mother jumping up, sure that the servants have been misbehaving while she was asleep, Beauty staring in some confusion at the smiling young man who is going to carry her off and make her a wife. Everything back to normal, everyday, commonplace, ordinary life. The silence, the peace, the magic. Gone. Really, it is a grand, deep question, the poet asks. It takes me into the story as no Freudian or Jungian or Bettelheimian reduction of it does. It lets me see what I think the story is about. I think the story is about that still center, the silent house, the birdsong wilderness. That is the image we retain, the unmoving smoke above the chimney top, the spindle fallen from the motionless hand, the cat asleep near the sleeping mouse, no noise, no bustle, no busyness, utter peace. Nothing moving but the slow, subtle growth of the thorn bushes, ever thicker and higher all about the boundary, and the birds who fly over the high hedge, singing, and pass on. It is the secret garden. It is Eden. It is the dream of utter sunlit safety. It is the changeless kingdom. Childhood, yes. Celibacy, virginity, yes. A glimpse of adolescence, a place hidden in the heart and mind of a girl of 12 or 15. There she is, alone, all by herself, content, and nobody knows her. She is thinking, don't wake me. Don't know me. Let me be. At the same time, she is probably shouting out of the windows of other corners of her being, here I am, do come, oh, do hurry up and come. And she lets down her hair, and the prince comes thundering up, and they get married, and the world goes on. Which it wouldn't do if she stayed in the hidden corner and renounced love, marriage, childbearing, motherhood, and all that. But at least she had a little while by herself, in the house that was hers. The garden of silence. Too many beauties never even know there is such a place. Townsend Warner's lines haunted my mind for some while before I realized that her question had led me not only into the folktale of the Sleeping Beauty, but into a story I had to write about it. In this case, the influence was almost direct. I am not anxious about it in any way. I am cheerfully grateful. My story is called The Poacher. Its title describes exactly what I, the author, was doing, poaching on the folktale's domain, trespassing, thieving, hunting, tracking down something that happened in the place where nothing happens. In my story, a peasant boy lives at the edge of a forest where he poaches and gathers a very poor living for himself, a nasty father, and a gentle stepmother. I find reversing stereotypes a simple but inexhaustible pleasure. The stepmother is not much older than he is, and there is a sexual yearning between them that can find no solace. He discovers the great hedge where it cuts across a far part of the forest. This impenetrable, thorny, living wall fascinates him. He keeps going back to it, exploring along it, when he realizes that it forms a circle, a complete defense of something within it, some other place. He resolves to get through it. As we know from the tale, the magic hedge is yards thick, yards high, and regrows two razor-thorned shoots for every one that's cut, so anybody trying to get through it gives up pretty soon. The 12th fairy's spell decreed that it would stand for 100 years. Only when the 100 years are up will a certain prince appear with a certain sword which will cut through the monstrous tangle like a hot knife through butter. Our peasant boy doesn't know that, of course. He doesn't really know anything. He is dirt poor and ignorant. He has no way out of his life. There is no way out of his life. He starts trying to cut through the hedge. And he keeps it up for years with the poor tools he has, slowly, slowly defeating the ever-regrowing vitality of the thorn trees, pushing a narrow, choked opening through the trunks and branches and endless shoots and tangles, doggedly returning and returning until at last he gets through. He does not break the spell. That is what the prince will do. He has broken into the spell. He has entered it. It is not he who will revoke it. Instead, he will do what the prince cannot do. He will enjoy it. He wanders about the fields and gardens inside the great hedge wall and sees the bee sleeping on the flower, and the sheep and cattle sleeping, and the guardians asleep by the gate. He enters the castle, for in the tale as I knew it, Beauty's father is the king of the realm. He wanders among the sleeping people. My poacher says then, I knew already that they were all asleep. It was very strange, and I thought I should be afraid, but I could not feel any fear. He says, I knew I trespassed, but I could not see the harm. He's hungry, as he has been all his life. The venison pastry that the chief cook had just taken out of the oven smelled so delicious that hungry flesh could not endure it. I arranged the chief cook in a more comfortable position on the slate floor of the kitchen, with his hat crumpled up for a pillow, and then I attacked the great pie, breaking off a corner with my hands and cramming it in my mouth. It was still warm, savory, succulent. Next time I came through the kitchen, the pastry was whole, unbroken. The enchantment held. Was it that, as a dream, I could change nothing of this deep reality of sleep? So he stays there. He has always been alone, that is nothing new, and now he is not hungry. Not even sexually, for he shares a sleeping peasant girl with her sleeping lover, and she smiles with pleasure in her sleep, and there is no harm in it, for the spell holds. Nothing can be changed, or broken, or hurt. What more can he desire? Speech, perhaps, which he never had much of in his old life either. Here there is no one to answer if he speaks, but he has vast leisure, time without end, and so he teaches himself to read. He reads the princess's book of fairy tales. He knows then where he is. Perhaps he knows what more there is to desire. He knows who the princess is. I knew that she alone in all the castle, might wake at any moment. I knew that she, alone of all of them, all of us, was dreaming. I knew that if I spoke in that tower room, she would hear me. Maybe not waken, but hear me in her sleep, and her dreams would change. He knows that to break the spell, all he need do is move the spindle in her hand so that its tip does not prick into her thumb. If I did that, if I moved the spindle, a drop of red blood would well up slowly on the delicate little cushion of flesh above the joint, and her eyes would open. Her eyes would open slowly. She would look at me, and the enchantment would be broken, the dream at an end. My story, like Townsend Warner's poem, merely asks a question. It does not alter anything. All will go on as told. The prince will come. His kiss will wake his virgin bride. I and my poacher had no desire to change the story. We were both just glad to get into it, to be there, awake. Thinking about it now, I believe that the tale is as impregnable and unassailable as its hedge of thorns. We can play variations round about it. Imagine peasant trespassers or rapist princes, happy or unhappy endings as we please. We can define it. We can defile it. We can retell it to improve its morality or try to use it to deliver a message. When we're done, it will still be there. The place within the thorn hedge, the silence, the sunlight, the sleepers, the place where nothing changes. Mothers and fathers will read the tale to their children, and it will have an influence upon those children. The story is itself a spell. Why would we want to break it? Postscript, 2003. I want to take this opportunity to pay a little further tribute to Sylvia Townsend Warner, whom I had the great good fortune to meet. When we were in England in 1976, our friend Joy Finzi knew how much I admired Sylvia's work and thought she might enjoy meeting me. So after talking me up a bit, I imagine, and giving Sylvia some of my poems, she drove me to the cottage on the river in Dorset, where Sylvia had lived for many years, first with her lover Valentine Ackland, then alone. The place is marvelously described in her letters and turns up in several of her stories. It was a sort of a naiad of a house that seemed to be only partly above water, with bits of beautiful, muddy, unkempt garden and the murmur of the river all around it. We had a cup of tea in a sort of sunroom at the front of the house. Antiquities from Valentine's antiques shop still stood or lay about here and there, or possibly they were part of the furniture. Sylvia smoked more or less continuously, as she had done for 60 years or so, and it was impressive to see the golden brown walls of the interior rooms, which had been white. Smoke varnish lay so thick on the glass of the pictures that you couldn't make out the pictures. Of course, some of it may have been wood smoke from the fireplaces, too, in that dank place. Sylvia was old and tired and reserved and kind and keen as a splinter of diamond. She said she liked one of my poems, Ars Lunga, which is about being a storyteller, and since then I have liked that poem better myself. I asked her about one of her stories, which I had read long ago in The New Yorker and had forgotten the name of, about a nice English family on a picnic. At the end of the story, a stranger sees them. One of them is wearing a blood-stained Indian shawl. Two of them are in 18th-century costume. The father is sitting on the ground listening to an enormous music box while the mother approaches with a birdcage. All this has come to seem perfectly reasonable to us, as it does to the family, because we know why it is so, but the stranger does not, and the reversal of viewpoint is revelatory and ravishingly funny. Sylvia smiled happily at my description and said, "Oh, yes, I do remember that," but she couldn't remember what it was called either, or where I could find it. No wonder. She had published 9 volumes of stories, and this is not in any of them. It is A View of Exmoor, in the posthumous collection One Thing Leading to Another. She also published 7 novels, of which Lolly Willows is perhaps the still most amazing, though I love The True Heart and The Corner That Held Them as well. Her last major work was a stunning biography of T.H. White. Her poetry has been collected at last. Her brilliant letters and her heartbreaking journal have been published. I think she is still esteemed at something like her worth in her own country, though she seems largely forgotten here, where most of her stories were first published. I hold it one of the dearest honors of my life that I knew her for an hour.